Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
Well, Chris Funk has written Drought, Flood, Fire, How Climate Change Contributes to Catastrophes. It's out via Cambridge University Press, and he joins us to discuss it. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm very happy to do so. Before we get into the meat of the book, I did want to kind of ask a couple things, that questions that came up when I was reading the acknowledgments. Because I noticed you thank a group of friends, and I quote you as saying, you know, without their support and guidance, this book would never have seen the light of day. Was there like an initiating event that they convinced you to do this book, or like what are you referring to there?
No, it was more that I started having similar conversations, with non-climate specialists, and kind of ending up going over the same basic ideas. And, you know, so, and those people were all over, you know, some of them were in the United Kingdom, and, you know, working with Oxfam and humanitarian relief. A big influence were our local volunteer firefighters here in Santa Barbara. And I started doing some radio shows on their community alert, AM radio. And then I was also having conversations with journalists, you know, who are calling in to try to understand climate change impacts in Africa. And one of the things that I noticed was that, you know, I kept having kind of similar conversations. And, you know, I understand, kind of through those conversations, you know, it really helped me appreciate that there were lots of smart people who were interested in how climate change was impacting us. But because, you know, we haven't studied this in grade school or high school or even typically college, you know, there were some pretty simple ideas that most people, you know, weren't familiar with. And so it seemed like as kind of a public-facing climate specialist that I was well-suited to try to communicate those.
So was the idea then that taking some of the questions that you had been asked by these people in these conversations and, you know, outside of an academic setting, and trying to apply answers to them or provide like what you would say to folks if you were having these conversations in a manner in which they could kind of see graphs and figures and, you know, maybe a slideshow presentation?
Yeah. And I mean, there's, you know, a ton of, you know, figures in the book. But just as important are, you know, descriptions of, you know, mechanisms that hopefully everybody can understand. So for example, just this morning, I got an email from a reporter, Aurora Almendral, and sort of one of the motivating moments to write this book came a couple years ago in December, when we're not supposed to have fires, and I was standing on a hill. I live up in the mountains, and I was standing up on a hill watching a fire, burn about 3 miles away towards Painted Cave, where I have friends that live. And I was having a telephone conversation with Aurora about, you know, what was causing droughts in East Africa. And, you know, it's just this kind of like surreal supposition. And so that was, you know, I think part what, you know, led me to want to write the book.
Right. The other thing in the acknowledgments was with your regards to your editor. And so that was what you indicated, was that, you know, he modified the text and structure of this work. Did you like kind of map out a framework and then he helped you kind of like reframe it, or what kind of like modifications are we talking here?
Yeah, no, I mean, mostly just, you know, improving the text so that it was, you know, more legible. I mean, I was really pretty shocked at how kind of on board with the basic book structure Matt really was, because it's a really, you know, unique book that's trying to do something that is really different than standard academic texts, you know. And, you know, I submitted the book proposal to other, you know, a few other publishers, and, mm-hmm. you know, definitely some publishers were like, what the heck is this? You know, but Matt really got what I was trying to do. And so, you know, most of his edits were just not really changing the intent or structure of what I was trying to do, but just, you know, tightening it up and improving the language.
Right. Now, you mentioned that this is not a traditional academic text. I gather then that you entered into this intentionally, that this wouldn't be, I mean, even though it's, you know, it's Cambridge University Press, but like you're releasing it on an academic imprint, but that this isn't necessarily what you'd expect from an academic imprint. This is a purposeful thing on your part in terms of like kind of the language you use, or like kind of how you convey the message?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and not to, I don't want to knock, you know, there's lots of great, you know, kind of academic books on climate change out there, you know, and so it's not that I want to criticize them, but, you know, but what I was trying to do was really reach a broader audience. And also, you know, I've done a lot of classroom teaching at the high school and kind of, you know, middle college level. And, you know, I think I'm pretty good at trying to put complex ideas in accessible ways. And so I wanted to do that. And, you know, the idea was that this wasn't going to be, you know, if somebody already has 20 books on climate change, it wasn't to try to make this be the 21st book. But it would be rather if, you know, somebody has no books on climate change, this is a pretty good place to start.
Right. Now, with that in mind, and with the thinking about, you know, teaching high school students and stuff like that, how much of, you know, like on an initial draft is deciding kind of how to convey complex ideas in simpler language, or is it, you know, sort of chunking things out into like smaller pieces so that you can kind of then drill down on each piece? Like, how do you determine?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, this is really like the third, you know, kind of massive revision of this book. And those all kind of took place before I even proposed it to Cambridge Press. But it really took me really years to try to come up with a format that I thought worked. And, you know, the sort of logic of the book is that the first, you know, four chapters really are kind of a primer in both climate science and climate change science. And or not in an exhaustive way, but I try to convey kind of the most important principles. And I also try to do it in a way that shares the appreciation that I have and that I think most climate scientists have, you know, for the incredible planet that we live on. So you kind of lay down the foundation, and then you use that foundation to look at different types of, you know, climate extremes, droughts, floods, fires. And the goal is that instead of the reader just believing me, you know, that he or she can understand, you know, why we seem to be seeing this big increase in weather and climate extremes.
So is it kind of like, does it share a similarity with the way you might build a curriculum for a course over a term?
Yeah, definitely. But I'm trying to do it in a sneaky way.
Right.
So, you know, so it's definitely doing it like you would build a curriculum in the course. And I'm, you know, was actually really quite careful in thinking about, you know, what got included and what didn't get included. And, you know, one of the things I think good teachers do is they know what to exclude. You know, it's like, what are the things you, because it's hard to learn this stuff. And so I try to just boil it down to some of the most important parts and lay those out at the beginning, and then, you know, and then basically use them to explain things later in the book.
Those decisions around exclusions, is that something that you've just kind of developed a knack for as an academic, or like, was there something where maybe your editor said, oh, there's just too much of this? Or is there a circumstance where you're just like, maybe this is not necessary? Like, how do you, what is the kind of process by which you decide, no, not this?
It was, you know, things that were, that basically, you know, that everybody could understand and that there was very little uncertainty about, and they had a big influence on, you know, weather and climate extremes. You know, one example that just comes up over and over, over again in the book, is the idea that warmer air holds more water. And, you know, this is just like 1,000% correct. You know, there's nothing to believe or not believe about it. And, you know, it's a basic fact that people can experience, right? I mean, we all, you know, understand how this works in our gardens, for example. And, you know, you can go from, and this was the conversation that I was having with Aurora a couple years ago, you know, as the forest burned across the way, that kind of, you know, it was kind of really telling, you know, and so basically that simple fact, you know, can explain a lot of the increase in wildfire extent that we're experiencing right now, because the warmer atmosphere will draw more moisture from dead sticks and leaves and living plants, drying out our forests, you know, which lets them, once you have a fire, you know, then it can, you know, burn faster and get much bigger. So, you know, so like if we take fires, you know, there are lots of complicated things that control, you know, ignition of fires. There's lots of complicated things that control, you know, the winds that can whip a fire into a frenzy. But this piece about dead fuel moisture, right? The moisture in sticks and leaves and the relationship to climate change is, you know, dead simple. And so, you know, that would be the piece that I talk about in this book, and not those other points. And it's not that those other points aren't important. It's just that, you know, they're really complicated. And then, you know, sort of at the other end of the spectrum, we can think about hurricanes and cyclones and take that same physical principle that everybody can understand, that warmer air holds more water. And, you know, this is increasing the intensity of really extreme precipitation events and hurricanes and cyclones, just because there's more water in the air. And, you know, so that's not the only thing that's going on, right? Modeling hurricanes, tornadoes, all these things can be incredibly complex. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are pieces to the puzzle that are really, you know, very hard for even me to understand. You know, and you really have to be like a hurricane specialist, which I'm certainly not. But there's a piece of it that you know, that everybody, you know, can get the story. And these are first order effects that are having a big influence.
Well, and both those, in the case of the fires and in the case of the hurricanes, you talk late in the book, in the Dixie Cup Planet chapter, about, you know, the positive feedback of climate change. And yeah, by positive, yeah, you don't mean like good, obviously.
Yeah, right.
there's a distinction to be made. But that, you know, these things kind of drive down and create more like because of the sort of closed system of the earth that these things, you know, exacerbate themselves or have like spillover effects, right? And you're talking about, you know, the polar ice, and you know, there's less to reflect sunlight, right? And so then there's these downstream effects. I'm struggling for a different term to use, but that it's, they feed into each other. And so we do see more of these. And then that, I think, kind of gets to what you were, you know, referring to, that you're seeing this fire in December when it's,
that's right,
not a traditional time to see it.
That's right. Yeah. Just, and, you know, yeah. So, you know, here in Western, you know, California, right? I mean, we're seeing these increased temperatures are just really desiccating the forest, right? And of course, we've seen this in Western Canada and the Pacific Northwest region. Mm-hmm. We saw it in Greece this summer. It's happening in Turkey. You know, it's happening in Northeastern Russia right now. And it's also, we're seeing increasing fires and desiccation in the Amazon and the rainforest. And, you know, there are real concerns that these effects, you know, both release, you know, more carbon into the atmosphere when all those trees burn, which is a, you know, a positive effect, or a cascading effect, maybe is a good word. And then they also reduce the forest's ability to sequester carbon, to pull it down out of the atmosphere. So that's just one example, but yeah, those are all things that we should be very concerned about.
The other thing from that chapter that I want to talk about, so you talk about representative concentration pathways, or as you know say, it's a scientific word for scenarios, which I appreciate that you just was like, oh, here, let's just call them scenarios for now, or RCPs. That you talk about the kind of four scenarios that kind of map out, not necessarily best case and worst case scenarios, but some possibilities based on kind of what's happened so far and projecting as to what could happen. And as the title of that chapter suggests, you know, possibly driving towards a 4 degrees Celsius change. And, you know, particularly looking back at what you point out as a 1 degree change over the course of the book up to that point, how drastic things have been so far, and what a 4 degree Celsius change means. When you're writing a chapter like that, is that a bleak chapter to write for you?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, and so, you know, I do a lot of work. I consider myself a humanitarian earth scientist. You know, I do a lot of work trying to predict droughts in Africa and help guide humanitarian assistance. And, you know, so a huge motivating factor for me is that a 4 degree, you know, temperature increase in Africa, you know, there's just kind of universal agreement that that's just really game over. I mean, it's going to be really bad. And again, I think also these sort of cascading effects, you know, in terms of the ice, you know, losing a lot of ice and decreasing the albedo of the earth, losing the forests, losing the coral reefs, you know, having the ocean become acidic and that reducing its ability to sequester. Yeah, those are all very, very real concerns.
Go ahead.
Oh yeah. Well, so yeah, those are all very real concerns. But one of the reasons that I wrote the book is that there've been, you know, really, you know, great expositions of those risks, you know, for a long time. But what I was trying to do in this book is, you know, help people feel and see, you know, what's already happening in the kind of half a degree of warming that we've had since the early 2000s. And then, you know, multiply that times 8, and that's what 4 degrees will be like, at least, you know, if not worse.
Right. And also pointing out that these things are not, it's not a linear path, right? Like that one thing can disrupt another thing, like more like a, with a more deleterious impact sooner, right? Like that it's not like a one-to-one, like this follows this in a chain, but that they are interrelated and can drive each other.
That's right.
In a way we can't effects. Really anticipate.
And there are also like really, you know, kind of like super critical thresholds. And, you know, like when I wrote the book, I was, you know, really shocked at how big the fire season was in 2018 in California. And then 2020 came around and you know, four times as much of the state burned. And this year it looks like we're on track to beat that, you know. And so I think this is, you know, there's basically, in terms of wildfires, there are, you know, are these dead fuel moisture kind of critical levels, like about less than 10% or so, you start getting these mega fires once you have ignition. And, you know, so, you know, even between the time that I started writing the book and the book is published, you know, the amount of area that is really having these bone dry fuels has increased a lot. And so, you know, you can have a linear increase in temperature, but you have a nonlinear decrease in these dead fuel moisture levels. And, you know, that's a big part of what's been happening. And we're just seeing this explosive growth in the extent of wildfires.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the timing of the book, because, I mean, obviously, I mean, at this point, you could release it at any point in the last few years, and it would seem very timely. Because, you know, as you said, 2018, the California fires, the Australian wildfires, you know, and then over the course of this summer, you know, here in the Canadian prairies, drought, you know, fires in Alberta and BC. It's, but I have the feeling like you could release this next spring and it would still be an entirely on point and relevant book, because this is something that's a system that's not going to stop at this point.
Yeah. And, you know, in 2015, which is when I really started to, or 2016, I guess, you know, when I really started to be drafting the beginning of this book, you know, none of that stuff had happened. And I was just looking at the data going, wow, this is looking really bad. Somebody should write, we're heading in the wrong direction really fast. And, you know, that wasn't the general impression in 2015 or 2016, or maybe even 2017. So, you know, the book was quite prescient, actually, in terms of, you know, being ahead of the curve on this stuff. So it's kind of, interesting to see. Interesting is not the right word. I don't know what the right adjective is. you know, yeah, the fact that the book has come out right in the midst of all these drought, floods, and fires, I guess, means that I was right to be concerned.
Right. Like that we've seen all three of these things over the course of this summer as the book hits shelves and you know, people start to read it, that it seems entirely prescient, but I have the distinct feeling based on, you know, the climate science that you document in the book that, you know, summer 2022, you could release this book and we would be seeing a lot of the same weather systems and problems.
That's right, Michael. And I think that speaks, you know, that to the kind of validity of my intuition to focus on these simpler mechanisms, mm-hmm. you know? So for example, you know, weather is very local. Like we have very local weather that drives the winds here in Santa Barbara, and that would be different than, you know, what happens in, you know, Alberta or British Columbia, right? But this desiccating effect of increasing temperatures is very simple and totally universal.
Right.
And so, you know, so that's why we're seeing, you know, it happen in so many different places. And, you know, I think focusing on some of the simpler aspects, you know, is is really powerful.
You'd mentioned earlier, you know, the fact that there was not really much in terms of academic study on climate change, you know, for folks in school. In terms of addressing that now, like I have to imagine, A, this book is kind of, you know, an attempt to address that. But when it comes to the notions of like denial of climate change, do you think that's just like the fact that there hasn't been the education around the science, or is it like obviously some like, you know, bad actors in terms of spreading kind of misinformation?
I kind of feel that there are kind of three aspects to that. You know, in one, I'm just going to paraphrase what my volunteer firefighter friends, you know, say about the book and about me, which is that, you know, that the messenger matters. And, you know, so they like talking with me because, you know, I'm just a straight shooter guy who's going to focus on the data and, you know, be respectful of them and the work that they do. And so, you know, because I'm basically a, you know, a kind of frontline hazard specialist, you know, I think I have a good perspective to speak to this topic that's not, you know, super snooty and academic. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, another thing I tried to do with the book is make it faith friendly. You know, I think that there's kind of an impression that science presents this view of the world as really cold and austere and kind of antithetical to a belief in the divine, you know, and I don't think that that is true. And so, you know, I'm not trying to be overboard with it, but, you know, in kind of crafting the story, I talk a lot about, you know, how this is a really incredible planet that we live on. And, you know, how that there are, it's like this miracle machine that supports life. And so, you know, I tried to, you know, present a view of the world, which is just my view of the world. I wasn't making it up, but, you know, but that it's very, you know, that it's not a kind of atheist, cold, dead world that that we live in. And then finally, the third thing is, you know, by presenting tons of data, but also these explanations, you know, I am, you know, offering up the opportunity for people to understand how climate change works. And I'm not asking them to believe me because I'm an expert, you know, and, I, you know, that has been done a lot by other people and other processes. And, you know, and that's a, you know, it's things like the intergovernmental panel on climate change and, you know, authoritative groups like that, you know, is important, but clearly, you know, this thing of people saying we are the experts, you need to believe us, isn't really working well enough. So I wanted to try something different.
Well, hopefully folks will read this book and come to an understanding of the climate change and its impact on all of these things we're seeing on the Weather Channel and on the news. The book is Drought, Flood, Fire, How Climate Change Contributes to Catastrophes, out via Cambridge University Press. Chris Funk, thanks very much for joining us here on the show.
Oh, yeah, Michael, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the chance to discuss this work and the work that you're doing.